You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
Here comes a real tough bunch in from the hideout. The Uranium Gang.
And welcome to episode 205 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by Jay Kluwit from Deep Blue Sea, the podcast, to discuss a 1969 film that gives us an underwater adventure with a 60s rock band at its center. Starring Tony Randall, Janet Leigh, Jim Backus, Ken Berry, Roddy McDowell, and Richard Dreyfuss? Directed by Jack Arnold, it's Hello Down There. But first...
We are about to unfold for you an adventure in the world of...
The Forgotten Filmcast.
Yum, yum. It's time for a tasty and refreshing snack. Promise to satisfy your hunger, your thirst, your sweet tooth. So visit our refreshment center now. Let's go!
Names of merchants who give dividend tickets are listed in the lobby of the theater and on circulars at the concession stand. Dividend tickets will be accepted on all standard box office priced films. So take a circular with you today and start saving dividend tickets tomorrow when you shop. See your next movie completely free.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
What does it look like?
I can't describe it. The hideous part of it is it's making the children obey its every command. The children are completely in its power.
And we're in the power of the children.
Space Children,
spreading a network of terror through a top-secret missile base in a nation's desperate hour of decision. Space children, the dangerous pawns of a power so strange that no sentries can stop them.
Why did you let those children inside here?
Dr. Warman, what children?
Stop it!
No rocket can rise anywhere in the world.
4, 3, 2, 1, fire!
No army can destroy them.
Get those kids out of there!
I say that if you were injected with this, you'd revert to a primitive anthropoid, physically as well as mentally.
One scientist dared investigate the incredible phenomenon. How a pet dog reverted to an antediluvian wolf.
Look at those teeth. Pet dog is a throwback.
How a simple dragonfly had become a winged monster of a species extinct for millions of years. Now, before your very eyes, see a man revert to a half-human anthropoid from the dawn of creation. A monster leaving behind a trail of death and destruction.
Oh, it's impossible. Nobody's got a footprint like that.
I'll rest when I find a killer.
That's not your responsibility. That belongs to the police.
Madam, I know what I'm doing.
Even he did not suspect the incredible truth. Neither did the police, nor the girl coming to keep a lover's rendezvous.
Comes the wackiest movie ever made, the wackiest wagon train in the West. Bob Denver from Gilligan's Island, Forrest Tucker from F Troop.
Wagon! Ho! Ho!
Gilligan was never this wacky. It's the wackiest movie you'll ever see, the wackiest wagon train in the West. Rated G for all ages from 6 to 60.
3, 2, 1, showtime!
Hey, you're supposed to be relaxing.
Yeah, I am.
Mm-hmm. Problems?
No.
No.
Viv?
Hmm.
How's the writing coming along?
Oh, I really think it's going to sell. It's all about a girl piano tuner who works in a harem.
Girl piano tuner, huh? Gee, that's brilliant.
Can you look at those children?
Viv?
What, dear?
Listen, why don't you write a story about a family that lives in an experimental house?
An experimental house? One that you design?
Right. And I promised T.R. that this family would live in it for the next 30 days.
Without even consulting us?
Gee whiz, I thought you'd love the idea. T.R. insists that we have a family to test it, so...
Test it? The house has to be tested?
Oh,
is there something wrong with it?
No,
it's going to fall down or something?
No, the family has to be tested. Their reactions to the modern conveniences, the ultra-modern comfort.
Where is this
the
house?
The breathtaking beauty of the decor.
Where is this house?
The push-button labor-saving devices, the beautiful, magnificent, ever-changing view.
Where is this
house? The serenity,
house?
The beauty, the charm.
Fred.
Yes?
Where is this house?
Oh, it's about 3 miles off the coast.
An island?
And it's built on a foundation of solid rock, about 90 feet.
About 90 feet what?
Underwater.
Underwater! You must be out of your mind! Oh, no, Captain Bly. You're not giving this girl the deep sea.
Honey, the house is watertight.
Well, I think you're tight and not on water.
Have you ever known me to take a drink?
Ralph, you've been nipping on Myrtle's tonic. You know I'm terrified of water. I can't even swim.
You don't have to swim. We get there in a submarine.
A submarine? Oh, that's marvelous. That's wonderful.
Honey, will you
don't you touch me.
How do you know you won't like it when you haven't even tried it?
I haven't tried cutting my wrist either because some strange instinct of self-survival says drop the razor, Viv. And right now it's saying drop dead, Buster. Don't you touch me.
This is pure hysteria. You haven't given me one rational reason.
All right, I'll give you a rational reason. I don't like the neighborhood.
It's very exclusive.
Good. Then exclude me out.
Where are you going?
I am going to my bedroom.
Now, just a minute. You mean our bedroom.
Oh, that's where you're wrong. I mean my bedroom.
Viv! Honey! Baby! Oh, come on!
And furthermore, I hate you.
Would you like a little more time to think it over?
Okay, our movie this time is Hello Down There from 1969. And joining me to discuss this film is Jay Cluett from Deep Blue Sea, the podcast. Jay, welcome back to the show.
Hello over there. Hello. You're not really down, is you're pretty up from me, sea level wise. So hello up there.
Yeah, I guess that would be right. I am significantly higher when it comes to sea level. So, yeah, I should be saying hello down there to you, I guess.
There we go.
Well, for the folks that have not been here before, Jay's been on the show many, many times. But for the folks that have not been here before when Jay's been on, please remind everybody who you are.
Yes, I think my credits change every time I come on, so that's fine. So, yes, I used to host the Lambcast. That's where you and I first knew each other. Since then, I now do Deep Blue Sea, the podcast, which I've been doing for 3 years now. We've been going 3.5, where we first started covering the Deep Blue Sea trilogy, all three of them, scene by scene, DVD chapter by DVD chapter. So that's 33, and a couple of bonus ones for that first film, then 10 for Deep Blue Sea 2 and 11 for Deep Blue Sea 3. Mm-hmm. We still like to see the reactions of people when they say, like, Deep Blue Sea 2 and Deep Blue Sea 3, is like, wait, you know, those. You're making things up, right? Surely. They are real films. Deep Blue Sea 2 is a lot of fun. Deep Blue Sea 3 is actually very good. You can pass out from that sentence the quality of Deep Blue Sea 2, if you like. But they're a lot of fun. So we've covered those, and now we're doing Deep Blue Sea adjacent films, which is any film featuring sharks or aquatic action or directed by Rennie Harlan. 2 out of 3 of which we're covering today.
Yes.
And since I was last on, I think I credited Con Air, the podcast, last time I was on where we did Con Air scene by scene. We have now finished that. So that is done. We're not doing Con Air adjacent films. We stopped that and just went back to Deep Blue Sea because my co-host Mark and I, finishing Con Air, we looked at each other and goes, we just missed talking about Deep Blue Sea. And I was like, yeah, we do. So that's all we do now is just talk about Deep Blue Sea films.
Well, I continue to be impressed that you've gone as far as you have talking about Deep Blue Sea and Deep Blue Sea adjacent films, because I think I've told you before when you first started this, I thought, okay, well, you know, that'll run the course of the film and that'll be that, you know, but you keep going.
That was entirely the plan. And then we're like, hey, people listen to this and we like doing it. So and just looking at my spreadsheet, I've still got well over 300 Deep Blue Sea adjacent films without even really trying to find more. So, and we've got to the point where any film can be Deep Blue Sea adjacent if you just try hard enough. And then there's films like Hello Down There that I didn't even know existed, and two others that you pitched I didn't know existed that also would be Deep Blue Sea adjacent and have been added to the spreadsheet. So one day we'll get there.
I'm doing my part, Jay. You know, I know you're just you are wanting things to do, so I just gotta keep putting them out there for you.
And the great thing about Hollywood these days, they keep making shark movies. We love shark movies.
I was thinking the same thing because I was like, I mean, not just shark movies, but just things that have to do with underwater. I mean, it seems like the last year or so has been pretty good for underwater set films. You know, a year ago we had Avatar 2, you've got Meg 2, you've got the Little Mermaid remake. There's been a lot of beneath the waves action going on.
We've covered all three of those. Well, the Little Mermaid remake is coming out in a couple of weeks from recording this, but we've done Meg 2, we've done Avatar 2, both very fun shows. Like, people, whenever like trailers come up to people, they keep sending me like things, hey, there's a shark film coming out. I was like, yes, thank you, more please, send me more. there's a remake of it's an unofficial remake of Airport 77, but with sharks in it, coming out soon.
Wait a second. I haven't heard of this.
But it's nothing to do with Airport 77, but it's a plane crash lands in the water and everyone struggles to survive, and there's sharks. Which, when we covered Airport 77, my main problem was, where are the sharks?
Like, yeah.
Jaws has been out for 2 years at this point. There should be sharks. But No Way Up is coming out next year. And it features Cole Meany from Con Air. So he's one of the people I was, maybe even the pilot, I don't know. He was like the pilot from Die Hard 2. he's now trapped underwater with other people with sharks. It's like, great, fantastic, more of this. And there's so many stupid shark films out there, but there's also so many sincere ones. And we try and cover the whole gamut. Coming up soon on Deep Blue Sea is House Shark, which is a guy, it's a house, and the house has a shark infestation. And it's it's the stupidest film we've ever covered. It's kind of a parody of bad shark movies, but it, like, the shark has a ray gun at one point.
As they do, yeah.
Yeah, as they do. And there's a guy with like a fake German accent wearing lederhosen who turns out he's just a shark scientist in disguise. There's a guy, all the characters are named after American presidents. For no reason, it's never referred to. It just is. And there's a guy with a really bad fake beard, and you think, is this just a fake beard? Because it's completely the film. And the end credits, he's like, my fake beard's fallen off. Like, it's that kind of film that references how terrible it is. So we cover that kind of thing. We've yet to cover a Sharknado. I don't ever want to, but we may do it at some point. I don't know. I've never seen them.
Those are the ones that everybody expects you to do, but you know.
Yes, they're the ones people assume we've already done.
Right.
Because they're intentionally making bad films, and that's not our bread and butter. We like to talk about films that people have tried to do the best they can. Not everyone succeeds. You know, we talked about the career of Rennie Harlin. He has made some terrible films, but he's never set out to make a terrible film. He always tries. He's always inflicted with unfortunate circumstances. So he's had literal plagues on his films. Like, Deep Blue Sea had a plague of locusts on the set. The Exorcist had flies, I think. He's had three or four films that have had literal plagues of bugs. And God does not want him to keep making films, it seems. odd because there's so much religion in a lot of his movies.
Well, and I think I saw a news story a few months ago that he's returning to shark movie territory. Isn't there one that he's working on?
Yes. It's called Deep Something. It might be just called Deep Water.
I think it's Deep Water.
Which, yeah, makes sense. But yeah, so he's very busy. He has four films coming out in 2024, which is, he's keeping us in business, so that's great. But he's doing the Strangers trilogy all coming out next year, as well as The Bricklayer with Aaron Eckhart. And then he's got another film I know nothing about, and then Deep Water is in production at the moment. Because he said in an article, this is like a plane film and a shark film. He said in the past that he's had all the success doing things on planes and things on the water. And we're like, yes, you have more of this. And so we are thrilled that this is coming out. We cannot wait. We may end up covering it scene by scene. I don't know.
They could throw in some pirates, throw in an exorcism, cover all the different aspects of his career. Yeah.
I think he would be the first to admit that Exorcist films haven't served him well in the past. And in fact, neither have pirate films, although we love Cutthroat Island. But it's an infamous bomb. How much money that film made. But we had loved it so much. I'd never seen it before, but now I adore. Yeah, Freddie has such a bizarre career, and I really enjoy it. So just going through exploring his filmography is a lot of fun.
Now, one that I've been meaning to ask you about at some point, I don't think you've covered this, but I thought this is such an obvious thing, but I know there's a movie that's called not Deep Blue Sea, but The Deep Blue Sea. That has like Rachel Weisz and Tom Hiddleston. I haven't seen it, but I saw the title pop up once and I was like, is that going to make it someday? Or is that considered like sacrilege? You know, you can't just add the to the title of Deep Blue Sea and expect to do your own thing.
I have never seen it. I think Mark has. I've got it on DVD ready to cover it one day, but that day hasn't arrived yet. It feels too much to not do it, but it's there. So maybe it will be like an April Fool's episode or something. When like the Deep Blue Sea, and we'll just like start halfway through talking about a random scene in the middle. I don't know. But I'm sure it'll definitely be covered one day. I doubt it'll be very high up there in the deep and blue rankings, is just my guess. And because to listeners who don't know, every film that we cover, I analyze, but how deep the action is taking place and how blue everything on screen is at any point, and come up with an average at the end of it. I don't know how this started. I don't know why it's kept going. It's the most arduous thing to do in the world sometimes. But I like doing it.
I was going to say, Jay, the reason that started is because I've known you long enough to know that you like to analyze things. You like to make lists of things. And this seems like it fits those categories.
I do love a spreadsheet.
Well, let's get on to this movie here, which I mean, certainly, you know, has deep and blue elements to it here. This is called Hello Down There from 1969. It's directed by Jack Arnold, director of many films for, you know, basically a 30-year time span between 1950 and 1980. Most known for some classic 50s sci-fi films. Things like It Came from Outer Space, The Incredible Shrinking Man, The Space Children, but most famously, Creature from the Black Lagoon and its first sequel, Revenge of the Creature. Now, this film centers on a guy named Fred Miller, played by Tony Randall. He works for a underwater development company of some sort. And basically, the company has sunk tons of money into the construction of a house, like an underwater house of the future type thing. Tony Randall's character is basically like, yeah, we're going to run out of space up here on the surface someday. So we need to start planning for people to live underwater. This is much to the chagrin of his boss, T.R. Hollister, played by Jim Backus. He wants to scrap the project and destroy the house, but Miller is convinced that he can prove that this is a great thing by having a family live in the house for 30 days. And of course, the family he has in mind is his own. But there are going to be some challenges with this, primarily because his wife, Vivian, played by Janet Leigh, is afraid of water. So, of course, living underwater, not a good thing. Maybe she had a bad experience in the shower once or something like that. I was just waiting for that opportunity, Jay. I'm glad you laughed. Then we also have, he's got some teenage kids, okay? We've got Tommy, played by Gary Tigerman, and Lori, played by Kay Cole. They are part of an up-and-coming rock band called Harold and the Hang-Ups. And the Harold, who leads this band, is played by a young actor named Richard Dreyfuss. Now, the kids, they don't want to go live underwater because, you know, the band is on the verge of a big record contract. There's this quirky producer named Nate Ashbury, played by Roddy McDowall, who has an interest in them. And, you know, if they go live underwater, that's gonna mess things up. So they actually decide that they are going to go along with this undersea adventure, but only if the rest of the band can go with them. And so parents are like, all right, whatever, you know, it's perfect acoustics down there. You know, you can practice to your heart's content, whatever. So this whole crew gets in the mini sub, heads underwater, and goes to live in this house of the future. Now, the house has many new modern conveniences, not to mention that there's a pair of guard dog-like dolphins named Duke and Duchess, and a friendly seal who likes to watch the laundry machine named Gladys. Now, life, though, as I'm sure you can understand, is not perfect under the water. There are many challenges. This includes the occasional visit from some nasty sharks, a hurricane that's brewing above the surface, and a rival co-worker of Miller's, played by Ken Berry, who is mining the bottom of the ocean for gold. And also there is the confused military who thinks that the signals they are picking up from the house must be from some kind of enemy weapon. And then there is also the fact that Harold and the Hang-Ups are offered a chance to appear on the Merv Griffin Show, but are stuck underwater. So a lot going on in this weird little movie. There's a lot of familiar faces in this. In addition to the ones I've already mentioned, we've got folks like Charlotte Ray, Lee Meredith, Arnold Stang, Harvey Lembeck, and Merv Griffin himself, putting in a cameo at the end of the film. We've got lots of weird 60s pop music going on, a bunch of underwater diving sequences, which were directed by Rico Browning, who's most famous as the guy who actually played the Gill Man in the underwater scenes of Creature from the Black Lagoon. So yeah, a lot going on, a lot of deep blue sea action. So I'm going to let Jay get us started here. Give us a few of your thoughts on Hello Down There.
I had a lot of fun with this one. As I mentioned earlier, I've heard of this before. I'm less familiar with most of the cast than you or many of your listeners, probably, just given my age and country of origin. Tony Randall, not someone I'm that familiar with. Merv Griffin, not someone I'm that familiar with. But it's only really like Janet Leigh, Roddy McDowall, Richard Dreyfuss. are the three. They're like, oh, yeah, yeah, you and you and you. Okay, great. Uh-huh. You'll never work with sharks again. But I really liked this film. I had a lot of fun. I was like watching the whole thing. I was like, this, why is this forgotten? This is great. I mean, this is like so entertaining. Why didn't this catch on? And then it's because it doesn't have an ending. There's no end to this film.
Yeah.
It's like a big climatic scene set up, and then, oh, credits are here.
Great.
So I feel like these days it would get a low cinema score just from people going, like, what happened? It's just, where's the final scene? Because it's kind of building up to this big National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation kind of ending with the SWAT team is all breaking into the Crystal's house. You think, we're going to get that scene where the army or the Navy breaks in and you just don't. And it's stuff like right before this is about to happen. So that was frustrating. The whole way through, this to me felt like a feature-length sitcom pilot.
Yes.
From the 60s, it feels like a I Dream of Jeannie kind of thing, a Bewitched, where like, what if you were married to a witch? No, what if you lived underwater? Like, and all of the antics, would watch that show. All of the antics that happen, they're all kind of mild sitcom kind of stuff. What if there's a team sabotaging you, where the only thing that happens when they sabotage you is the floor pitches a little bit, and then the dad comes back and rectifies it, sends some antics with a stapler falling off a table, and oh, the washing machine explodes, but in a way that no washing machine would ever explode. Like, it's gonna throw some underwear onto Janet Leigh's face. That's the worst thing that's gonna happen. But the fact that there's just a band constantly playing throughout is very The Young Ones. And there's a band playing in the living room. None of the science makes sense. Like the opening shot of the film is two guys in a two-man submarine wearing full business suits. just that image of like, wait a minute, that's not what you'd be wearing. And like at one point, Tony Randall has to go diving to face the sharks, and he does so dressed in his everyday clothes, just with a face mask on.
Right, just throw on the air tank, the face mask, yeah, and you're good to go.
He has no weaponry, but he confronts the sharks. He has like a diversionary device that's going to attract them somewhere else. But he and a couple of dolphins defeat this like gang of sharks that's just shown up. So it's silly. It's not as silly as some of the films we covered on Deep Blue Sea, but it's entertaining, and I enjoyed myself greatly.
Yeah, silly is a good word. It's a very strange movie. I can't say it's terribly good, but I was entertained. And I think for some of the reasons you said there, I did definitely have that kind of 60s era sitcom feel to it. And I mean, I was raised on that stuff. I was a kid in the 70s. That stuff was all playing in reruns. So I Dream of Jeannie, Bewitched, all that kind of stuff. That made up my day. I guess we should start by saying that this is definitely not as meant to be anything outrageous or edgy or anything like that. I mean, this is a family film. It was created as a family film. In fact, they re-released it again in 1974. Paramount was doing this kind of family matinee series, and they released it as a part of that. I think they even changed the title when they re-released it to Sub-a-Dub-Dub.
Sub-a-Dub-Dub, yeah.
But, you know, it's going to be, you know, very much geared towards a family audience. And a lot of the humor is stuff that, you know, kids are probably going to find funny. The adults may roll their eyes at a bit. I mean, it's very much in the style of like Disney live action films from this era. It really kind of feels like they're trying to emulate that feel, which is strange because I can't really think of any other films that try to emulate that Disney live action style, because 60s and 70s Disney live action films are generally not considered to be very good. So,
but you have the likes of like Mary Poppins, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. They're from that era. But this is more brightly colored than all of those, I think. Like I love the set. I just think the colors, the whole thing, they really pop. Everything's so brightly colored. It's like when they're in Nate Ashbury's office and he's got there's Dr. Wells, the Lee Meredith character, when she's like at the computer. There is no outfit pinker than what she is wearing. Like, yeah. Barbie would shy away from looking at that coat she has on. It's like, it hurts the eyes.
Oh, yeah. No, the look of the film is wild. And I'm not talking about in terms of like cinematography or anything like that. The cinematography is very much, again, TV style. But the look of everything in the film is crazy. I mean, like I say, the clothing, very bright, strange patterns. I mean, it was great. Janet Leigh in a few scenes here is wearing some really wild pattern type stuff. And I was like, oh, I'm not used to seeing Janet Leigh in clothes like that. And then, yeah, just the look of the house in general, lots of bright colors, lots of, you know, weird things around that you're going, okay, I don't know what that is, what that's supposed to do. It's supposed to be something science-y. It looks cool. I mean, it looks like Epcot, you know?
Yes, yes. The world of tomorrow.
And yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it looks like Epcot, or probably even more accurately, like Tomorrowland at Disneyland when they built it in 1955, trying to guess what the future of 1995 would look like. It's just that kind of cool retro future type of a vibe to things. And that was probably one of the things I liked about the film the most, because yeah, there's a lot of stuff about this that you go, well, this is silly, and you're kind of rolling your eyes, but kind of that cool retro futuristic feel to things I thought was fun.
I completely agree. Yeah, I feel like if this was made today, the underwater house would be a lot more lavish than just one big living area and then a couple of bedrooms. But it's very simple. It's a simple set. There's a big open pool in the middle, which has real Deep Blue Sea vibes. I was expecting Sam Jackson to make a speech on the side of that. And it didn't happen, so sadly to say. But like the newfangled, the first thing that Fred shows Vivian, his wife, is her new kitchen.
Yes.
It's very 60s as well. Like, this is your new kitchen. This is your new fridge. It's in the counter. This is your new dishwasher. It's in the counter. This is your new washing machine.
This is every woman's dream, I think he says. Something along those lines, yeah.
Your new hot plate. This is your new garbage disposal. And like, later in the film, the house is being cleaned by Vivian and Laurie. No one else. Oh, what are we cleaning next? The boys' bedroom. I was like, well, the boys should clean their bedroom. What are they doing right now? Nothing. We sat down writing a song or something. So yeah, it's very, very 60s. A lot of eye rolls from my wife was watching this. Justified, entirely justified.
I love that stuff though. Just, you know, kind of the gimmicky nature of you know, the fridge that pops out of the counter and all that stuff. You know, the weird idea of what in 1969 they thought the future was going to be like. It's charming and it's fun to watch it and look at. Wow, look how wrong they were. You know, it's like watching Back to the Future Part 2, you know.
But it's not even set in the future. I think this is supposed to be contemporary.
Right.
It's 1969. We built a house under the water. This is what we've done. this is what it would be. And the whole premise is in the future there's going to be so little land or so many people, everyone's going to have 1 square foot each to live on. So what we need to do, go underwater. Like, how can you ignore 71% of the Earth's surface? I like the premise. I like you and I have talked about sometimes these kinds of films can be overly preachy before. I love Wall-E. You like Wall-E less than I do because you think it's too preachy. I think that this better handles that, where it's that set, that premise of like, the world's doomed, and then they don't talk about it again. They just set it up and then they move on. So that's something to appreciate, I guess.
But, you know, they aren't exactly doing much to really help the situation in terms of, like, if they're concerned about the environment. You know, the whole garbage disposal system, which is what attracts the sharks in the first place,
yes,
is a little off. I mean, the problem is that, you know, she accidentally pushes the button that shoots the garbage out of the green onion. That's what they call the underwater house, the green onion. It shoots the garbage out, and so then the sharks are attracted to that somehow and they go attack it. And, you know, it's because she didn't incinerate it first. She's supposed to incinerate before they eject. But I'm like, you're still ejecting crap out into the ocean. So what, how's that helping things?
It's baby steps. Like they say, like, all of the energy, everything comes from the water. So that's great. They don't tell you how. They don't explain that. They say, everything comes from the water. It's like, great, well done. But yeah, we're still chucking stuff in there. Which is only going to make the ocean deeper and make less and less land. But one thing at a time, I guess. She's distracted by the band playing another song. And those sharks are immediately there. It's not like she puts out there and there's a little hanging around. No, the sharks are there. They are waiting for this rubbish to be ejected. It's silly. I like it. I'm not going to complain about any of this. I had a lot of fun.
Well, let's talk about the sharks then. I mean, you know, you have a podcast that's all about shark movies and things like that. So, how do you rate our shark action here?
Well, I was thrilled when there was some. I went in not knowing there would be sharks, and there were sharks, and I was so happy. I think that was the point where I messaged you, like, we should cover this on Deep Blue Sea. Like, this isn't just for your show. It's just my show, too. It's fine. A lot of the undersea creature footage is just, like, B-roll, I think, or just kind of, they're just filming people hanging around. So that, right. There are some scenes with the band are playing, and they cut to, like, the animals are dancing, where there's, like, a three-second clip of a turtle. They just play and then reverse it and then play and reverse it. So it's like he's dancing.
Yeah, it's like under the sea.
it's exactly like under the sea. So a lot of the shark footage is the same, where it says, hey, let's film some sharks swimming around. Which, 1969, there's no CGI in this. It's just filming sharks. That's what you're going to get. But when they have the fight sequence, where they have dolphins fighting sharks, it's like, yes.
Yes.
That's incredible.
that was great.
Because they have this, there's like a balloon they can release that's got a chemical in it that will attract sharks somewhere else. They release one, and it pops too early. And it covers the house in this stuff, so all the sharks get attracted back to the house. So they do another one where Tony Rando has to swim away, and release the balloon somewhere else. So that's when he's fighting the sharks. So the dolphins just come out of nowhere and help him, and it's very well edited nature footage, I think. It tells a good story. They manage to compare, like, hey, the dolphins arrive, the dolphins fight the sharks go away, the dolphins survive. Like, we get all of that just from... like undirected footage. You can't tell a dolphin to go and attack a shark. That's not how it works. Can't do that. So I'm impressed with how they do it. I don't want to know if they did do that, like how they managed to coax these kind of things happen. I don't want to know. I just appreciate what the result they got.
Well, it actually looks like they did do it. I mean, I'm no dolphin or shark expert here, but I actually, for another project I was doing a year or so ago, had to do some research on dolphins and saw that there are certainly cases where dolphins have protected swimmers or other dolphins from sharks, and they will ram them and things like that. And you actually see that happen in this. You see a dolphin come and rams its nose into the shark, and the shark swims off, and they add a nice little thunk sound effect when the dolphin rams into them. But I watched it a couple times, and I was like, that looks legit. That looks like that's a real dolphin hitting a shark. And I think it was. So, you know, that was kind of cool to see. And then, of course, the icing on the cake of the whole thing is, you mentioned Tony Randall has to go out there and swim around and release these balloons manually or whatever it is. And, I'm 100% sure that's not Tony Randall out there actually scuba diving. In fact, I'm pretty sure it's Rico Browning, because as I was watching the way he swam and stuff, I was going, the way his legs are moving looks just like the Gill Man. I'm pretty sure that's got to be him. But there's like one shot where a shark is swimming over him and he kicks him. I mean, he lifts up his flipper foot and just kicks the shark in the stomach, and the shark swims off. And I was like, all right, that's pretty cool.
I didn't notice if there was a bit in the credits where, like, no animals were harmed in the making of this film. I didn't look for that.
Yeah,
I didn't see that.
They didn't do that.
I guess that's probably not that.
Yeah.
Like, we hurt as many sharks as we could making this film. You're welcome. Which, no, I love sharks. But yeah, I mean, this isn't how you make films today. Don't go out there and do that. If like the dolphins are protecting other dolphins or people from sharks, that means that people were in danger. From sharks. So, again, not best practice for filmmaking. The results speak for themselves.
Well, and we have to mention, too, that one shark gets hit on the head with a guitar.
It does.
Because that little pool where the subs come into the living room and such, and a shark actually pops up. I liked that we did get some shark action going into the underwater house. I was glad for that. But I definitely was not expecting one of them to get clunked with a guitar.
Yeah, it's always fun to see a shark just kind of plunked inside of a home. It doesn't happen in many films. So when it does happen, it's always, hey, that's not something you see every day. But yeah, that's the drummer hits it with a guitar, I think Marvin, who is my favorite character, I think. He's just always this massive grin on his face. Whatever's going on, he's just grinning in the background. It's like, I'm reading after him. He doesn't do anything other than hit a shark with a guitar. Other than that, he's just like, yeah, great, I'm having fun.
I definitely want to talk more about the band here in a moment. But while we're still on the subject of the underwater stuff, let's just talk a bit more, just kind of the underwater stuff in general. I mean, beyond the, like, the shark and the dolphin action, I mean, we get plenty of shots of scuba diving. We get plenty of shots of, you know, the underwater house. There's this other project that's going on where Ken Berry's character is in this, like, kind of like underwater bulldozer weird thing. He's trying to collect gold and such. Yeah. I mean, clearly model stuff. Did it work for you?
I mean, I didn't hate it. It did kind of feel like this film's only 63 minutes long. We need to add a bit more. That's had a rival down there. That's had Chiva. Because they don't really, pay off a lot. It's another obstacle to overcome that's not really tied to the overall. Like, I did like enjoy the pitch meeting of like, there's just gold, magnesium, and uranium just lying around on the seabed. It's like, no, there's not. Uranium, definitely not. But we've developed this thing that's going to suck it all up and find it, and we'll get rich. And I did like when they were telling TR, what about that? All the cash register noise in the background. And he's like, gold, ka-ching! Uranium, ka-ching! Magnesium, ka-ching! Like, no.
Yeah.
And then he picks Jonah, Arnold Stang, as his sidekick, just because his name is Jonah. And he thinks, hey, someone was named that same thing, and they were in a bit of a whale for a while. This is going to work. And Jonah is useless. Utterly useless, incompetent fool.
Yeah.
lets all the air out of on Elton canisters just by, like, leaving them open. and just being an idiot. So there's some fun, just like physical comedy going on there. And he just dismisses Jonah. We never see him again. So presumably...
Yeah,
underwater. Oh, no. He's 3 miles away from land. It's a long way to swim. And 90 feet down is not like, you shouldn't just go straight up from there.
No.
But this is 60, they didn't know. So Jonah died. I think it's safe to say. Jonah's just never made it home.
It's a family film. We can't go there. Come on.
I enjoyed Chiva. He's like always a bit beleaguered. He's always like on the phone to TR, and TR's like, how much gold you got? He's like, nothing. Nothing at all. So it's a fun character. It could have been expanded a bit more, like when he goes and steals some of the oxygen from the green onion. It doesn't really pay off at all, other than that he drops his spanner.
Right.
So then when Fred goes there to confront him, he finds Chiva is unconscious, and he just saves Chiva. But there's no like confrontation. Like, you tried to sabotage my thing. How did you save my life? None of that happens. It's just, you know, he goes, he drags him back because he's been buried in sand. First time I watched this, and he opens a big pipe and it gets covered in this like brown sludge. And like, what is that? Like, so this is, how long have they been down there? Is that all the waste they've been collecting? Mm-hmm. But it's sad. It's sad. And it's just, it doesn't really pay off.
No.
The whole cheapest nonsense. But it's still, there's some fun in there.
Well, and the whole like device that he's in, the HOD or whatever they called that thing, it seems a lot more thrown together than the green onion does. The green onion, as we said, has got this real, you know, kind of fancy look to it and all these conveniences, and you know, it's this technical achievement, and then they just kind of have this thrown together weird underwater vacuum bulldozer thing. And you know, I hate to say it, but I got like images in my head of that whole mini sub catastrophe from earlier this year, the implosion thing that
sure.
was going
yes.
on. You know, it's like, this does not look safe at all.
So I feel like we could expand on a backstory here if we wanted to, and say like Chiva got word of Fred's plan and saw that it was being like adopted by TR. I was like, I've got to do my own thing. And so he hurriedly finished his little draft and rushed in so he could be the golden boy. He could try and get the promotion, because you know, Fred's been given this kind of ultimatum kind of thing, where if he and his family will stay down there for 30 days, he becomes head of sales. If mm-hmm. they come back, he's fired. Which doesn't seem fair, but okay. So Chief might have heard that and goes, oh, this is my ticket to a promotion. If I can spend 30 days collecting gold, then I'll be head of research or something. And so he's like rushed it through and it hasn't worked. And he's just trying. He's really trying. And it's just not happening.
Well, I was really confused by the jobs of these various people to start with. Because like Tony Randall's character, I mean, he created, designed this underwater house. So he's like, you know, I don't know, some kind of a architect or an engineer. I don't know. But then suddenly that makes him a scuba diving expert too. And, you know, I wasn't clear on exactly what role everybody played in all this. Plus, not to mention the fact that at the beginning, Tony Randall's telling Janet Leigh about, you know, all this stuff with the underwater house. And she's like completely shocked. Like she knows absolutely nothing about his job. She's his wife and she knows nothing about what he does for a living.
I mean, not only does she not know, TR also doesn't know. His boss doesn't know what's going on at all. I think my favorite quote from the film is anytime somebody explains the house to somebody, it's just a response of, "The water!" It's ludicrous, it's insane. So yeah, she has that, Richard Dreyfuss says that over the phone. I think Marshall has it at the one point. And yeah, so he, like, the opening scene in the little 2 months of going to the, like, TR's like, what is this? Underwater house? Ridiculous. Like, you've been paying for this.
Yeah.
Like, this thing costs, they say, like, $200,000, I think. Like, that's your money. In the 60s, that's a lot of money. And like, you should, why aren't you more interested in this? Why haven't you, like, been checking the receipts? This is entirely your fault at this point.
He just cares about all that uranium, you know, that's all he wants.
I did get a very deep vibe from it, because, like, Sam Jackson has no idea about anything when he has to have everything explained to him. It's, you know, it's a storytelling device. It's weird, you know, it's to tell us what's going on, how much everything costs, what everything does. I get it. But you could write it a little better, I guess. Like, it could be explained differently. Just explain it to somebody who genuinely shouldn't know. No, it could all be being explained to Richard Dreyfuss's character.
Well, yes. Let's speaking of that, yes. Let's move on to the band here, because I think one of the strangest things about this film is that you think it's going to be this underwater adventure, that it's going to be all about this house of the future underwater, and we get scuba diving and sharks and submarines and all that stuff, but the story is very quickly hijacked by a 60s pop band that wants to be on the Merv Griffin show. And I guess one of the things that is the strangest about this, and again, going back to what I was saying about Disney live action films, one of the things that various of those Disney live action comedies from the late 60s, early 70s struggled with was an attempt to make a squeaky clean, family friendly comedy, but at the same time, address what was going on with the youth, with the counterculture, with the hippies. And this movie seems to be doing that same thing, where it's like, we're going to put this bubblegum pop 60s band in the middle of this stuff and take every single opportunity we can to have them play their songs and such. And it's just a weird diversion that kind of overtakes the whole film. So I guess, what's your thought on Harold and the Hang-Ups here and all that's going on the musical side of this film?
Yeah, you're not kidding with every opportunity to play their songs. There are, they play four different songs, the band. There's also the title song of Hello Down There, which is just the words Hello Down There repeated again and again and again.
Yeah.
The band plays four songs, most of them many times. Like, the soundtrack is just the tune from all of these played again and again and again as well.
In their entirety, too.
Yes, it can get a little repetitive. But I mean, I was surprised when, like, Tony Randall was like, what family are you going to take? My family. Cut to a band playing. So, what is going on here? And why are they still? And they're still playing, and they're playing again, and the band's coming too. And wait, they're taking a submarine down here, and it's towing a drum kit? Okay. Sure. I liked them. I thought Rich Dreyfuss needs to work on trying to look like he's actually singing these songs and not having...
The voice doesn't sound anything like what you would imagine Richard Dreyfuss' singing voice sounds like.
Yeah, not in the slightest. The songs are fine. I'm not gonna add them to an iTunes playlist anytime soon. I'd like that he writes the... Dreyfuss' character writes the entirety of Hey Little Goldfish in a matter of seconds. Just by, like, seeing a goldfish, and hey guys, just follow me, play this, and just sings the song.
Do what I do, yeah.
Which, I mean, one of my favorite podcasts is Off Book, which is an improvised musical podcast. They write they improvise a whole musical every week, or they did. The podcast has since ended, but I still love it. And so people can do that, but I sense his character come. I don't buy that from Harold.
See, I've always struggled with that a little bit, because it happens in movies a lot. Heck, Marty McFly does it in Back to the Future. But I've always thought, how do you make a song that sounds like it's, you know, right off of the album, you know, perfectly recorded and all that, on the spot there at the Fish Under the Sea dance? Yeah, I'm not buying that.
How do the rest of the band know when to come in with the oohs and another, like, what? And they just know where you're going with the guitar and the, yeah, okay, I get it, fine. I guess you've been working together for a while. You've got good chemistry. You all live in the same bubble. I get it. Fine. My main stand-up for Dreyfus is that red outfit he's wearing at one point is very odd and not what I would pack to live underwater for a month. But you did. So well, what did you think of the songs?
While you're talking about the fashion there, I will say all of Richard Dreyfus's outfits in this are strange and not at all what I would expect Richard Dreyfus to ever wear. But that's beside the point. Yeah, the songs are goofy. I mean, they do have a little bit of charm to them. I admit I do have a bit of a soft spot for 60s bubblegum pop type of songs. I'm not going to say these are terribly good. You know, they're all right. The Hey Little Goldfish song sounds like a song that like the group The Lovin' Spoonful would do.
Okay.
And then the one that's just called like Glub. that's weird. I guess the songs though were actually written by a pretty well-known songwriter. It's a guy named Jeff Barry. Yeah. And like I was looking through songs that he's written, and I mean, first one of the things that stood out and definitely kind of ties into this movie, he was the guy that kind of supervised the creation of the music for the animated show The Archies back around this same time. So like the song Sugar Sugar, he wrote that. And you know, the idea that you just have this band tagging along is very much like what you have in a show like The Archies or some of those other shows where just, you know, everybody had a band type of a thing. But Jeff Barry, he wrote Doo-Wah Diddy Diddy and Then He Kissed Me and Chapel of Love and Leader of the Pack. This guy wrote a lot of iconic songs.
River Deep Mountain High.
Yeah, you know, these are definitely not iconic songs. These are weird little earworms. And I think, you know, if I had heard them once in the movie, I would have liked them more than, you know, the fact that we hear them like four times each in the movie.
Yeah, like there's at one point where the band gets, they go on a little detour in a submarine to go and try and be on the Merv Griffin show, and they get stuck and they're trapped. And so what do? They play a song. They play one of their songs again because they're trapped in a little submarine. They can't do anything. Hey, let's play a song. Let's start drumming on the dashboard.
Right. Like,
if you leave them alone for 3 minutes, they will start playing a song. That's all they do, which, you know, I have known some aspiring musicians. That's actually true. That's what happens.
Like, oh, yeah.
If you put... Like, you could be sat, if it's like four of you in a room, three of you having a conversation, and there's a musician who's feeling a bit of doubt, they will start playing a song. That's what, I mean, I've experienced that happen. It's actually quite irritating.
My brother is that way. My brother is a musician, and he always, you know, had drumsticks in his pocket, and he'd just start banging on things, you know, and yes, it can get very annoying. I love my brother. He's talented, but, you know, come on. Well, these four teenagers, which, I mean, I say teenagers in air quotes because they look pretty old for teenagers. I kept on wanting them to be a little bit quirkier, to have a bit more to their characters. They're just kind of there to play music all the time. I mean, there is some fun stuff. Like you mentioned Marvin. Marvin's a little weird, and I could get behind that. But, I mean, like a lot of aspects of this movie, there are seeds that are planted that are never fulfilled. Like, you know, when they first proposed taking the rest of the band members down with them under the water, the daughter says something like, well, okay, but if Harold breaks off the engagement, then, you know, I'm going to be upset. And they're like, engagement? What engagement? And then there's like no other hint that there's a romance going on between them.
No, yeah, you're right. That's I forgot about that. Yeah. And like, I feel like there's very little character to Tommy and Laurie, to Fred and Vivian's kids. Whenever like Fred wants to do anything, he addresses Harold. He goes to Dreyfus.
Yeah.
And like, you know, he goes to be like, we need to keep the women from getting too emotional. Like, help me with this. Like, Jesus, come on. But yeah, he always like employs Dreyfus to help him out rather than his own son.
Right. When the sharks attack, he's like, you know, get everybody into the sub, but Harold, you come with me. We're going to go battle the sharks or whatever, which, you know, I like to think I'm like, okay, in the alternate universe of my head, after this experience was all done, Harold changed his name to Matt Hooper. And, you know, then, you know, he, because of this whole experience, he was, you know, enthralled with sharks. And there we go.
I thought you were going to go with, at the ultimate universe of your head, Fred was trying to get Harold to be eaten by a shark. trying to end that engagement. He's like, you're not good enough for my daughter. Here, shark chomp.
That would have been good, too. Well, and before we move off the band, too, I want to talk about one of my favorite aspects of this film. I mean, we've got a lot of things going on here, a lot of characters, a lot of things where there's hints of something interesting that doesn't pan out. But for me, the best part about this movie was Roddy McDowall. Because I just think
You love Roddy McDowall.
I do. I love Roddy McDowall. But he's just so weird in this. And it's another kind of example of what we were talking about, where they're trying to tap into that whole youth culture of the 60s thing. I mean, just to start with, his character is named Nate Ashbury instead of Hate Ashbury, as in where the hippies hung out in San Francisco. But just, you know, the weird outfits that Roddy McDowall is playing, the way he sees himself as this, like, wonder boy record producer, which it's weird they keep referring to him like he's a teenager. Roddy McDowall was 41 when he made this movie.
I mean, Dreyfuss was 22.
But I mean, like, it's just such a bizarre part. And I'm looking at things going, Roddy McDowall turned down being in Beneath the Planet of the Apes and was in this instead in 1969.
Oh, is Beneath the one I really liked?
Beneath is the one with the bomb, where they all worship the bomb.
Yeah, Beneath is my favorite one. Spoiler for Beneath the Planet of the Apes, they blow up the world. And for it to be the second film in a franchise where they blow up the world, and you know there's three more films coming. When we covered those in the Lambcast many years ago, I was like, where is this franchise going? They just blew up the planet. There's three more films coming, and it's time travel. So great. I can't believe when that happened when I watched that film. So yes, I didn't realize he wasn't in that one. What a fool. He missed out on being the best film of the franchise.
Yeah, somebody else plays Cornelius in that one.
Yeah, I enjoyed. He brought a different kind of flavor to the film, he and Lee Meredith, just this, like, anarchic wunderkind producer just on a different planet to everyone else. And just that big data machine that Dr. Wells has, like, that analyzes how popular a song's going to be. And like, this is going to outsell everything we've ever done because the machine has now broken. That's how good the song is.
Well, and that whole aspect of things was weird too, because I guess in my mind, if you're all about the hippie culture and whatnot, you would have been like, hey man, the dollars don't matter, you know, just you be you and all that. But instead they're running everything through this computer to see what's going to sell. And I'm going, wait, you know, like he dresses like he's in the 1960s, but now suddenly they're in the 1980s analyzing all the data and seeing what's going to sell big.
Yeah. He's just kind of capitalizing on the hippie movement. Isn't he? Like, because he makes fun of them. He says, like, if there's anything these kids can do, they can grow hair. So he knows. Very unusual thing to say. But he knows exactly who his, like, market is and who his suppliers are, I guess, the musicians. But he's not in it for that. He's in it for the money. Mm-hmm. And yeah, which is, you know, he's a music producer. That checks out.
Well, I feel like we kind of skipped over the big stars of this film. We went right to the band. We should talk a bit about Tony Randall and Janet Leigh. What do you think of what they're providing here?
I feel like, not being very familiar with Tony Randall, he felt very much like a regular 60s, 70s sitcom dad role. Like, yep. His name should be Darren and something.
Well, the year after this, he began a long run on the Odd Couple TV series. So he's definitely a TV guy.
I regret to say I didn't look up where I might have seen him from before, so I'm kind of looking now, and I don't think I've seen him in anything. he was in a cameraman in Hitchcock's Saboteur, but uncredited. So that's his first role, and then did nothing for 15 years. So maybe I should check that out again to see if I can spot him. He voiced the brain gremlin.
Oh yeah, he is the brain gremlin.
Oh dear. That makes sense. I'm glad that I sussed out. He's a sitcom dad, and he was a sitcom dad. Makes me feel good. So I think he does great anytime he's not singing. That scene where he's singing Just One More Chance with all the animals swimming away, I wanted to do the same thing. No, thank you. Very bad. And he's singing a song to try and woo back Vivian and, like, sing something that he and the wife can enjoy. And the rest of the band are not happy about it. Everybody looks at Dreyfuss is like, like a little grumpy cat playing the guitar. And he puts on a fake smile and he goes back to being grumpy again. yeah, he's fine. Like, he doesn't do anything. He doesn't shine for me, but he, you know, he fits the role exactly. And the same for Vivian Lee. Janet Leigh, sorry, playing Vivian.
Janet Leigh, yes.
I think she was fine, but she wasn't given an awful lot to do other than overreact to some stuff. I feel like she was maybe over or under directed at times, where she's like, just play this big. Like, there's washing machines exploded. Go nuts.
Right, yeah.
There's an alarm going off. Fall in the water. It's antics. She's told to. There's not a lot of depth to her character.
I agree. In fact, I think Janet Leigh is the one who seems the most out of place here. And maybe part of that is because, again, going back to that kind of that 60s sitcom feel of things, a lot of the other folks in this movie are folks I associate with television. You know, Tony Randall, Jim Backus was from Gilligan's Island. Ken Barry was on F Troop and Mayberry RFD. He's been on lots of shows. Even Arnold Stang, he was the voice of Top Cat on TV.
What?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, all these people are TV folks in my mind. And then you have Marion from Psycho in there. And it's almost like Janet Leigh kind of feels like, what am I doing in this movie?
Why is there an actress in this film?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Because this is after Psycho. Like 9 years after Psycho. So, I don't know. I've not assessed her career. Was she on a downslope at this point?
I don't know.
She'd done like 2 episodes of Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Theatre of the Stars. No. It was almost a decade from Psycho. So maybe she wasn't at her peak. But then maybe she wanted to have fun. Maybe she wants to do a fun, quirky little Tony Randall film.
I got to mention, too, while we're talking about cast members and especially those that have kind of more history with television, I got to throw out Charlotte Ray being in this, playing the weird kind of loopy,
the drunken maid,
semi-alcoholic housekeeper, which, you know, is a weird big performance that she's given there. But it was funny to me because here she is playing this kind of crazy housekeeper, and the role that Charlotte Ray is most known for people of my generation is she was Mrs. Garrett on the show Different Strokes, where she was the housekeeper, and then that spun off onto the show Facts of Life, and she became, you know, a bit less kind of crazy and loopy as those series went on, but I always kind of think of her as a crazy housekeeper, and so to see her in this as the crazy housekeeper add alcohol was kind of fun.
Yeah, she's another one with big sitcom energy. So she's playing to the back seats at times with some of her reactions, and she's not even trying to hide that she has a drinking problem.
No.
She offers the drink to her boss. You seem worried, Mr. Miller. Would you like a drink? Like so my tonic has a big swig of it while she's supposed to be working. Not even trying to hide it. Is drunk the entirety of the film, I think. And then is dancing with Cheever at the end. And like she seems less into it than he does. it's great. I am unfamiliar with her as an actress, but I liked everything she did here. Check out some of her other work. I in that kind of role, kind of category, Jim Backus as TR was also very entertaining. You know, we've seen this role 1,000 times where it's just, he's the boss who's grumpy all the time. Right. And he fits it to a T. He brings a lot of, just a lot of character to it, a lot of entertainment, a lot of funny line readings. And he does a lot of voiceover work. And I can see.
Well, I mean, he's almost playing the role he's most famous for in this. He's most famous as being Thurston Howell on Gilligan's Island, the millionaire, and he's kind of playing the same part here. You know, he's got dollar signs in his eyes, and that's about all there is to him.
But he does it well. It's always fun. Hey, it's him again. Whenever like he keeps on cropping up on the phone, so it's good that they pepper him throughout the film. So we're never too far away from a Jim Backus. I'm telling someone they're an idiot. Mm-hmm. I'm like, give me more gold. How much gold you got? I need some more gold. always.
Well, let's talk real quick about the ending. Like you said, the movie kind of, you said it has no ending, which I was frustrated with that too, because there's all this lead up to, you think that the Navy's going to come in and attack, which again, the Navy has an actor who I love seeing show up in there, Harvey Lembeck. I'm a big fan of the old Beach Party movies. Harvey Lembeck shows up in there as Eric Von Zipper all the time. And he's in lots of other stuff too. He's in Stalag 17. You know, he's a great actor. And so, you know, having the Navy with Harvey Lembeck there, I was like, oh, okay, they're going to barge in at the end and there's going to be this thing. But no, it just ends. They play a song on the Merv Griffin Show and that's that.
See, it's the fact that they have all this footage of, like, every time the band starts playing a song, whether they're in the Green Onion or in a submarine, as long as they're underwater, doesn't matter where they are, the sonar guy, Harvey Lembeck, picks up on his sonar. That's some kind of secret weapon down there. We don't have a weapon. It's the enemy. So they the entire naval fleet, there's planes, there's boats, there's parachutes, there's divers, all brought out and all engaged and go, and we're heading towards you. Credits. What are you trying to do? I mean, yes, we can imagine what they invade, they attack, they all dance on the Merv Griffin Show. I don't know, but like, why would you set so much up and then not pay it off? I don't get it. I don't understand. It's so frustrating.
The studio was just like, nope, that's enough. We've run out of budget money. You're done. Play a song and roll the credits.
You may make exactly 97 minutes of film, not a second more. What is that? Okay, and I don't know, like, they could have just not had that whole it didn't pay off to anything. There's no interaction between the Navy and, but maybe that's why. Maybe they filmed the whole film and were like, huh. Like I said earlier, it was a short running time. So I had to add in like 5 minutes of extra footage, and so there's no one on the boat has any interaction with anybody in the Onions. They could have just all been filmed entirely separately.
You're right. And
that's what it feels like to me. Just like we have this footage from a different film where there's someone's hearing something underwater. That film's gone under. Let's just chuck it into Hello Down There and claim as a tax rebate.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Can we call somebody who's available to play a radar technician? I got Harvey Lembeck over here. Lembeck will work. Bring him in.
Done. Let's go.
Well, before we take it to the break, then Jay, I mean, we should cover the ground you always cover on your show. You talked about it before. How deep, how blue do we rate Hello Down There?
I was going to say leave this for the other podcast because everyone says to listen. This is because, like, it's going to be a reason to come and listen to my show. Because Todd and I have agreed to do this. This is cross promotion at its finest. The central part of this show is going to be available on Deep Blue Sea, the podcast, as well as Forgotten Filmcast. Different intro, different outro. But if you want to find out how deep and how blue this film is, then head on over to Deep Blue Sea, the podcast, a couple of days after this is released and listen to the episode there. Or head to my letterbox where it will be posted on one of the lists I've got there. Up to you.
All right. Well, do you have anything else before we take it to the break?
Just scanning through my notes. I mean, we skipped over TR lighting a cigar in an oxygen-rich environment in the submarine and setting fire to everything. It's good. We didn't talk much about the seal. That is the seal. She's fun.
Yeah, the seal was kind of like, I don't know. I'm like, you got two happy-go-lucky dolphins there. Do we really need a seal, too? And he's like, all right. It doesn't get in the way too much. It sits there and watches the laundry. So,
and like, she's an aquaphobe with a pet seal. I explain that. I just, how aquaphobic is Vivian when she can live in an underwater house with a big pool in the middle? I don't think she's that aquaphobic.
I did like the gimmick that she carries around an inner tube half the time.
And there's the picture of her on the beach, on sand on the beach, holding two of them. Yeah, that was, and yeah, you're not going to need that. I know, I'm going back home. It's a nice moment. And when the band are all need to go and be on the Muppet show, so like, Harold can drive a motorbike, therefore he can pilot a submarine. It's smaller, so it's easier. It was great. Cause, hey, it's not smaller. That submarine is bigger than a motorbike, for one thing. but the fact that I liked that he then couldn't. He tried and failed and grounded them. So that was nice. But yeah, I overall liked this film. I'm glad that this of the options selected, this is the one that I could find. This is the one that we watched.
Yeah, I mean, it's a film that, again, I'm not going to sit here and say this is great filmmaking. This is very much kind of a television level type production, but I'd also put it under the goofy fun type of category. You know, it's also kind of one of those movies that you watch and you go, wow, I kind of don't believe that this exists. You know, this is just, Who came up with this? I'm glad that they did, but wow, what universe am I in?
Yeah, it. I mean, I'm happy it does, but this is very much a forgotten film, and I can kind of see why, just because of that lack of an ending. The fact that I think only like 360 people have logged this on Letterboxd, that feels so low. I'm sure you have lower. I have lower. That just feels like none at all. And like, there's so many people who just don't know. I don't think it's ever had a UK release on any kind of physical media. I had to find it via ulterior motives. It's on the Internet Archive somewhere. So thank you to the runners of that. But it's like so hard to find. This needs a re-release. This needs a Blu-ray. This needs a 4K fellow down the Criterion Collection.
Does it need a remake? I mean, hey, you could take half the cast of Deep Blue Sea and put them in this one, you know?
You absolutely could.
Get LL Cool J down there with a bird? I mean, that's gold, right?
He already sings.
Instead of a 60s bubble
cast would do it.
Instead of a 60s bubblegum pop band, they're now a rap act.
Yeah, so what, you'd have like Thomas Jane and Saffron Burrows as Fred and Vivian. LL Cool J and Michael Rapaport LL Cool J as Dreyfus, Michael Rapaport as Marvin.
Yeah.
You'd have Janice. Well, I can't remember. This is terrible. McAllister. Nope. That's, oh God, I can't remember the cast of Deep Blue Sea. This is terrible. It's not like I've done 150 episodes on this podcast. Jacqueline McKenzie. I got there eventually. It'd be Laurie and. Stellan Skarsgård is going to have to be Richard Dreyfuss because he's her partner in that. And then LL Cool J can just be another brother. And Sam Jackson would be Tia. There we go. He's yelling at them over the phone.
And put Simon Cowell in there for Merv Griffin, and they can end up being on America's Got Talent or whatever, something like that.
Okay, I'd rather it be like Jimmy Fallon or something, just someone who like, can be entertaining and not everyone's cup of tea, but Simon Cowell cannot be entertaining. He's not a funny guy.
Jimmy Fallon would probably be all over this, no doubt.
I just make it the Jimmy Fallon show, and everything about it is me, and they occasionally cut to underwater. That's what I want. Ida Satoru would be the Charlotte Ray character. There we go. Just so she's in there as well. And we need a silent Ronnie Cox somewhere. I mean, has Ronnie Cox passed? Is he still with us? I can't remember. Ronnie Cox still alive, so he can still be in there somewhere. What's a silent character in this? There are. He could be the dolphin.
The dolphin.
And the cast of Deep Sea 2 can be cheaper.
There you go. Yeah. All right. Well, let's take a quick break here. We'll hear from another one of our podcasting friends, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
At Cinema Recall, we want to present to you the finest in film analysis.
Yeah, like action and gore and sex.
We will look at classics by Kubrick, Lynch, Godard, De Palma, and Coppola.
I don't know who the that is, but I'm looking at classic bodies of Christina Hendricks, Keanu Reeves, Salma Hayek, Ryan Reynolds.
We are a serious show for film lovers who enjoy indie foreign films, arthouse gems, and classic black and white features.
Well, I enjoy big budget blockbusters with great action and sexy people. Maybe our podcast can celebrate all aspects of films, like people who feel like your weird way and like people who feel like my weird way can like get together, man.
They can?
Yeah.
Huh. You know, I like that.
Cinema Recall is available everywhere you find great podcasts. Follow them on Facebook and Instagram under Cinema Recall Podcast and on Twitter at cinema_recall.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a quick reminder that you can now help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few measly little old dollars a month, you can support this show and earn access to some bonus features, including a bunch of the old episodes of this show, which are no longer available on the main podcast feed. Visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more.
We are like the Maury Povich of podcasts. People come to this show because it's a train wreck.
I'm giving this podcast 3 stars. The host keeps yelling at me.
The people have clearly spoken. Check out Whatever with Jason Sodal on Anchor, Apple, Google, wherever you get awesome podcasts, or you can go to the home location at rabbitholepodcast.com. Second thing I want to talk about is I want to talk about urination. I want to talk about peeing specifically.
See what happens when Jason throws out the segments. This is what we get instead.
Hi, I'm Chili Dilly, the personality pickle. Packed in a jar for the freshest flavor. Served cold in a sack for you to savor. So dainty to eat, no muss, no fuss. An ideal snack for all of us. Crisp, tender, and tasty with a bit of spice. Buy one now. Taste how nice. Snack bar clerks will knock themselves silly, speeding your order for a real Chili Dilly.
All right, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where we each get to talk about another movie that we want to encourage others to watch. It could be anything. It could be a forgotten film, an old classic, something new in the theaters or on streaming. Anything you want. So, Jay, what is your recommendation?
Okay, it's there is a connection. The title of this film is said a bunch of times in this film. Hello, John. There, it's from 2020. It kind of got ignored on its initial release. It kind of fell into the pandemic hole, I think, a little bit. I'm gonna recommend Underwater, which is a very different tone on a film set entirely underwater with people living in it.
Underwater.
Exactly. I'd love it if this title had an exclamation mark at the end of it. That would make me so happy. But this is your standard living at the bottom of the sea, things go awry, try and get out kind of film of a bunch of a deep sea drilling company may have drilled too far and done too much and may have awakened, I don't know, the Kraken. Who can say? And so it stars Kristen Stewart, which I think it turned a lot of people off as well. I think the kind of horror fans that would appreciate this don't necessarily overlap with the Twilight or Kristen Stewart, more prestige work fans. But she is really good in this. Vincent Cassell, also excellent. John Gallagher Jr., everything, he's great. And it's just a really tense, well-made film. It's not a huge budget. It looked great. To be honest, the first time I watched it, I thought it was terrible. But my co-host recommended it again, so I went back and sat through it again, knowing what I was expecting, and really liked it a lot more, because we have covered it on DBC. Spoiler alert, it is currently our deepest ranked film because it spends the entirety of the film at the bottom of the Mariana Trench, which it's difficult to get deeper than that. So it's more than double its nearest one. Leviathan is second place. This is a very deep film. But yeah, I recommend Underwater a lot. It's a really tense, got some great effects work. It's very claustrophobic at times. If you're scared of being underwater, this is the wrong film to watch.
Yeah, yeah.
But very different flavor than Hello Down There. Less comedy, some comedy. Far more people die in this film.
Well, I have seen this. It's been a little while. I remember when I first watched it too. I was a little bit neither positive or negative on it, but there were things that I thought, you know, it did do really well. And I do agree that Kristen Stewart quite good. I mean, it's a shame sometimes. I think people do write her off just because they're like, oh, that's the Twilight girl. I don't like Twilight, you know. But there's a lot of things that she's quite good in. So, yeah. You know, I think of her, you know, I don't go to Twilight. I go to things like Personal Shopper or Adventureland, you know. I was like, yeah, I like Kristen Stewart in these movies, you know. So
we're recording this around Christmas time. She's in Happiest Season from a few years ago. It's an excellent Christmas film I recommend to a lot of people as well. She's one of the leads of that one. I've only seen the first Twilight film. So I've only seen her be bad in one film. I haven't seen a lot of her films, but what I have seen, she's really great in Into the Wild in a small role. She's fun in Zathura, if you want to go back.
Oh, that's right.
She's like the oldest. She's in Flintstones Rock, Viva Rock Vegas, apparently. I will never know. I mean, she's great in Panic Room. She's always been good. Underwater.
Yes.
Underwater.
All right. Well, what I'm going to recommend here ties in a little bit, but I did not go with an underwater film. I kind of latched on to the whole idea of the House of the Future
type of a thing. And when Tony Randall was showing Janet Leigh around all the modern features of the kitchen and all that kind of stuff, it made me think of an animated short that I used to watch on TV as I was growing up. And so that is what I'm going to recommend. I'm going to recommend this Tex Avery directed short from 1949 that is called The House of Tomorrow. And it's a short that doesn't really have a story to it, but it's one where we have kind of a bunch of little gags, little vignettes that are all strung together showing the different features of this new modern house and all these modern inventions to make housework easier and all that kind of stuff. Tex Avery actually did several shorts that were in this style. This is one of my favorites of the films that he directed. Some of the inventions in here are pretty funny, pretty weird. I mean, like, to give you an idea, they do things like, oh, here's this amazing new invention that takes the burps out of the radishes before you serve them. And so they load the radishes in there, and the machine starts making all these little burp noises and all that, which, of course, when you're a kid, that's comedy gold right there. You know, burp equals funny. So, you know, but it's one of those shorts that also has a lot of what I always refer to as mother-in-law gags, where they will be like, you know, here's this new fancy automated chair that adjusts for, you know, different types of people. So it works for tall people, and they push the button and it changes into this skinny thing with a tall back on it. And then they say, or for short people. And then they push the button again and it turns into this squat little couch type of thing. And then for the mother-in-law, and then it transforms into an electric chair, you know. So there's a bunch of those kind of gags in this. In fact, one of the gags I always remember this too is one where they have a TV that has several different screens so that different members of the family can watch the shows they like at different times. So they do one for mom and for dad and for the kids, and the one for the dad is just this, has this girl in a bikini, and it's like an actual, you know, footage of a woman. It's not animated in any way. And so then at the end of the short, they're closing things out, and then suddenly this text appears on the screen that says something like, due to many requests to the management, we're going to show you the girl again. And then they show the footage again. They cut that scene out when they showed it on TV when I was a kid, because it was kids television. But anyway,
very Star Wars holiday special.
But
I'd love to be whatever it was. Yeah,
this is just, yeah, it's a fun, weird short with a lot of that irreverent humor that Tex Avery does so well. And it's fun just to kind of look and see, you know, what are the things that were considered modern for 1949. So I think you can find it online in some places. It's also on a Warner Archive released some Blu-ray collections of the Tex Avery animated shorts, and this is in there. So yeah, The House of Tomorrow.
Excellent. I have not seen that, but I will check it out.
Well, Jay, I want to thank you for being on the show. Before I let you go here, please remind everybody of where they can find you and all the things you got going on.
Sure. Thank you once again for having me and for letting me retain my title as your most frequent guest. Richard, it'll never be you. It'll always be me. So, yes, you can find me over at Deep Blue Sea. The podcast is the place you can find most of my work audio-wise. Lifeversusfilm.com is my personal blog, which is coming up to the end of a year, which means I will actually have things on it. Because I do an end of year list, and then it lies dormant for about 11 and a half months. That's how my blogging is these days. Sorry, but I intend to do a little ranking post of all of the new releases I saw this year. It might be words. There will definitely be pictures. We can promise you pictures, maybe words. And Con Air, the podcast, still exists. You can go back and listen to. You know, Todd was a guest on that. He's been a guest on Deep Sea a bunch of times. So talking about Jaws, the Revenge, and the two Poseidon Adventure films. A chapter of Deep Blue Sea, and I'm sure he'll be back again at some point to cover. I have plans for you, Todd.
Oh, I'm excited.
And you can follow Deep Blue Sea, the podcast, on all social media at deepbluesea.com, and my personal Twitter is Life VS Film, and my Instagram is at JAYCLUIWT, where you can see pictures of my dogs and little else.
Excellent. Well, thanks again for being on the show, and I'll be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast. that's going to do it for episode 205 of the show. Thank you so much for listening. Of course, you can find more reviews of Forgotten Films over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. I welcome your questions, comments, and feedback about the show. So please email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And don't forget about our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn all about how you can help support this show. I'd also like to mention a few other podcasts that I've guested on recently. I regularly guest on the Lamcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs. I was on a recent episode there where we talked about our Christmas wish lists for this year, so please check that one out. I was also on a recent episode of Out Now with Aaron and Abe, where we got to discuss the new theatrical release, Godzilla Minus One. It's a great movie, it's a great episode, so check that out as well. And of course, thanks for listening to this show. Come back again real soon. We'll see you next time.
Their manager, Nate Ashbury, tells me that he is stoned on these shouters, that they're mellow yellow, turned on and groovy, and the lead chick is so wigged out she's out of sight.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.